Blog Talk Radio.
No, he's just a coach. No, I got
Well, actually, technically, I did get his jersey. It's just on the back, says Tornado. Before, they would think it was me.
Nice.
Grandma,
give
me Mr. Groundhog.
Who'd you get?
I was in the car. I saw Grandma. I'm like, don't sleep. And I think, oh, boogie, Mr. Groundhog.
Well, there's an article I posted this morning, actually, about Charlie Manuel, your coach of the Phillies, and
he said that, you know, he wouldn't mind signing Bernard.
Yeah.
They had a couple of big articles in the Philadelphia papers about him.
Yeah, that's where it came from. Yeah.
They said, when Manuel just first took over, you know, like the first year of being manager of the team, he did his office one day, and Hopkins just popped in, sat down, and started talking.
And the Phillies, I think, have one of the best records in baseball right now.
Yeah. They played a 19-inning game last night.
Yeah, I saw that.
Thankfully they won, and thankfully I wasn't at that game, but unfortunately I went to a game they lost, and I was in a bad mood.
I think Oscar De La Hoya is in a bad mood these days. Have you heard the news about him?
I heard he's in rehab.
Rehab.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Up his profits.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, there was a subsequent article that came out that mentioned that cocaine was the specific reason he was there.
I didn't know. I knew it was rehab, but I didn't know if it was drinking or drugs, and if drugs, what kind of drugs.
Before I even heard what he was in for, all I could think about was that thing that when he had the stripper taking pictures of him.
Oh, yeah.
In ladies' underwear or whatever.
Yeah.
And what goes together with strippers but cocaine, you know? So that was my immediate suspect or drug he was on.
Yeah, you know these guys, and they can't be messing around with that shit.
Yeah. Not good.
Well, no, not at all.
But other than that, we had a whole lot of news to cover. We got the Iceman on tonight, coming on at about 8:45 p.m. your time. The Iceman, John Scully, to talk Hawkins. So he's going to talk our ear off for sure.
Okay.
And we got, I got a pretty good piece of news if you do like alcohol and not cocaine and you're a boxer. Or an MMA fighter, for that matter. Some researchers over at UT Southwestern Medical Center are going to be doing a study to find out whether a component in red wine and grapes could help reduce the short and long-term effect of concussions.
Wow.
So if you go and you get rattled in the ring.
After all the concussions I had, I was still okay.
Yeah, you like drink a lot of grape wine or red wine, or you eat a lot of grapes?
Let's just say I like my grapes fermented.
All right. Well, so I guess it's specifically going to be red wine because it's got that same chemical called resveratrol that also is supposed to be good for preventing cancer and to protect against cardiovascular health and against stroke and Alzheimer's disease. So, who knows, could even be good for older people too, with their brains, you know, getting all screwy from aging. Get drunk on red wine. And you really do have to get drunk because, according to the doctor in the study, he says even though it's found in red wine, you would need 50 glasses of wine to get the required dose to get the protection you would need.
Wow.
So not only a glass a day keeps the doctor away, 50 glasses. So maybe Kelly Pavlik had the right idea. Drunken boxer there for a little while. We also got UFC 130 coming up this weekend. It's a big, pretty big card. been a lot of talk, I guess, well, Rampage Jackson is the main event fighting Matt Hamill, and he's been kind of outspoken recently about wanting to just go into the movies, wanting to retire when he's 35, and that sounds to me like he's kind of slacking off a little bit in his training. And showed a big thing on Spike TV last night after The Ultimate Fighter about him going through his training and everything like that, and saying to the people watching, hey, it doesn't mean just because I'm going to retire when I'm 35 doesn't mean I'm slacking off. And I don't know his regular routine, but it didn't seem like he was, really going 100%, whether that was because the cameras were there and he didn't want to give too much away. I don't know, but I guess he's doing a little bit more weightlifting. He's got a new diet, and he's doing a lot of swimming and running and that sort of thing. But as far as workout routines go, I've seen better on these shows. So I don't know what that means, whether he's going to have trouble with him or not, but I just kind of was watching that thinking, maybe I should bet on him. We'll see. But he definitely lives a good life already. I mean, they showed his house, and he's got the A-team van, black and red van, and a nice car. Seems to be living pretty well, no matter what happens with his career. But he does say that he wants to make another run at the title belt, so we'll see what happens. I think he's like 3 years away from 35, if I remember correctly. So he's got a few more years left till his self-imposed retirement. Let's check his age right here. He was born in 78. June of 78. So yeah, he's got about 3 more years left, I think. And other than that, we got Big Country, the hamburger-eating big guy of the U.S. We should be sponsored by Burger King. He's fighting Frank Mir, a guy who's been back and forth. He's had the title, lost it, had it again, lost it. Fought Brock Lesnar, beat him, then lost to him. So, big time ups and downs. Longest win streak he had in his career, he had 2 four-fight win streaks back in the day. And during his last four-fight win streak, he beat Wes Sims twice, our buddy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, worst interview of all time.
I'm telling you, Rich, that was my first show, I think it was. My first show, I was like, I was about to give you, you know what, Rich, I don't think it was broadcasting things from me. So thankfully, the next week we got Simon Carr on, and everything was all well and good.
Right. Yeah, and he's coming off a win over Mirko Filipovic, which is not too surprising. Krokop is not what he used to be. He's Croatian police officer, and now he's actually a former Croatian police officer, I think. Now he's a diplomat. He's got some kind of elected position over there, I think, at this point. But he insists on still fighting. I think he's still going. And the UFC hasn't thrown him out yet, so we'll see what happens. But before that, he lost to Shane Carwin on punches. And Carwin's going to be coming up on a fight pretty soon. It's Junior Dos Santos in the next UFC because of Brock Lesnar's ducking out or bowing out, depending on how you look at it. That fight. Also, rounding around up that card, we got Travis Brown versus Stefan Struve, Brian Stann versus Jorge Santiago, Rick Storys fighting Thiago Alves, Miguel Torres versus Demetrius Johnson, Kendall Grove versus Tim Boach, Renan Barreo versus Cole Escovedo, Chris K. Carriasso versus Michael McDonald and Gleason Tebow versus Rafael Oliveira. That should be interesting. Boxing, we can't forget, last weekend we had the record broken.
Definitely cannot forget. I mean, you got to give the guy props. Did you happen to see that fight?
I didn't see the whole thing, but I saw the highlights with him doing push-ups between rounds. And
yeah.
Just really getting in his head.
And that's pretty good. From the moment they got in the ring, you know, he got in his head. Now, the first round was very uneventful. Only one judge had it a draw. Because, you know, we even looked at it. Neither guy really threw a punch until the last 10 seconds. And I think Pascal landed him like 4-2. You know, not all very scintillating right there. The second round was kind of still kind of slow action. Third round, Hopkins started picking it up, you know. So the first two rounds, okay, even if you gave both to Pascal, that's fine. And then it was, I think, like the fourth round, he stunned Hopkins with a pretty good right hand on, right behind the ear, almost on the back of the neck, and stunned him pretty good. But Hopkins fought back. And then by, the fifth, sixth, seventh round, you could tell one guy was picking it up and one guy was slowing down, and it wasn't the 46-year-old slowing down. And then he just started getting in Pascal's head. And even Bernard said it after the fight. He goes, this kid, he's a good young fighter. And he goes, and I hope he listens to what I'm saying. He said, because, you know, he's got potential. He's a good young fighter. But his problem is he swings for the home run every punch. And he's so tight that, you know, you can tell he wears himself out. And that's why by the end of the fight, you know, Hopkins just knew what he was doing. He was picking them apart. I mean, I had it 116-112. After six rounds, I had it 3-3, 57-57. And then I had Hopkins winning five of the last six rounds. And that was with neither knockdown getting called. Those knockdowns would have got called. Obviously, that would have really, made a big difference in the scorecard. They did not get called. So, you know, that would have just made it even a wider win for Hopkins.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. His boy, I don't know if he's a real boy, but his old guy boxing buddy, we'll say, Roy Jones Jr., didn't put in anywhere near that kind of performance. He got KTFO'd, as they say.
Yes, he did. That was, once again, scary. Roy needs immediately, no matter if he's having money problems, because I know he's, having some tax problems, I don't know. He's got to hang up the gloves. I don't care what he does. You know, he's got to hang up the gloves.
And I did get to watch a little bit more of that fight. For some reason, they had that posted up on my favorite bootleg site before they had the Hopkins fight. And it was against Dennis Lebedev, I think. Jones actually had him hurt. He knocked him up against the ropes just before he got knocked out himself. And there was a little bit of controversy after the fact because it kind of reminded me of the Rocky Marciano versus Jersey Joe fight where he just threw in the left hook after the right hand.
Right, yeah.
Injury. While Joe Walcott was already knocked out and hanging onto the rope. In this one, though, it was a right hand. Right hook, and Smoger was on his way in to stop the fight, and it was this time, though, I don't think Jones was really knocked out at that point until the right hook came through, and that was just a really rattling punch. He was on his way to being stopped, but he was still on his feet, and then the right hand came in, and he went right down. And the referee was Steve Smoger, a guy I think you really like. I remember you saying he's one of your favorite referees.
I do like Steve Smoger. I do think he's one of the top referees in boxing. I got the opportunity to meet him at a fight card a few years ago. And it's cool now because now when I see him, I'll see him on a fight card. I'm like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, hey, what's up? And We were talking to him one time because he was talking to my friend like Gary Rosado, who's you know, an up and coming referee. And we were just there talking to him, so we started just talking and, you know, realized how cool of a guy he was.
All right. Yeah, and I don't really blame him for that stoppage. I mean, I think sometimes they just invent controversy out of thin air. And it really wasn't his fault, you know. He was already between the two fighters when the guy threw the punch, so I don't know what else he could have done.
I'll tell you, you know, I first watched it on YouTube, and I saw Jim get hit with a couple left hands, and I saw him, like, kind of bend down, and I couldn't tell what happened just from the angle. And then I looked over again, I must have blinked my eyes, and then he's, like, laying, like, flat on his face. And I was like, holy shit, what happened? Then when they showed the other angle, you see him get hit with that overhand right, and, like, kind of, like, pitch forward, and then he just got completely blasted and that put him out. Now, let me pose this question to you, Rich. I actually posed this about a year ago, right after the Hopkins-Jones rematch. And Hopkins won, but it wasn't, you know, a great fight, and Hopkins didn't look spectacular in it, and it was more of a case of Jones, you know, being past his prime. But the question I posed, and I've actually asked people this at a couple of Philadelphia fight cards, and at the time, and you figure this is in Philadelphia, so, I mean, you would get a little bit more of a bias toward Hopkins. And, in fact, remind me tonight, Rich, because I would like to ask John Scully this question also. You know, he's more of a neutral site. Well, you know what? Actually, he knows Roy very well, so I'd like to get his opinion on it.
Yeah, the clip that we used on the interview posting was him sparring with Roy Jones, so he does know him very well.
Yeah, he does. But, okay, let me ask this question. I want to get your opinion on it. Just for example, say Bernard decides to retire. He says, you know what? I don't need to fight Chad Dawson. I don't need to fight anybody else. I got enough money. It's time for me to retire. And Roy, after getting knocked out, says the same thing. You know, he goes, my health is, you know, more important to me. You know, I've been stopped in a couple of fights. Time for me to retire. So now you have two first ballot Hall of Famers. Now, a year ago, I posted this question. If they both go in on the same year, and I said, just for example, if August or April 3rd, 2010 was their last fight and they both decided to retire, and they both end up in the same Hall of Fame class, who gets top billing? And at the time, you know, you had arguments for both guys. Like, you know, Roy, at the height of his career, was quote-unquote Superman. I mean, he beat Hopkins when they were both, you know. Roy was a little bit ahead of Hopkins at the time due to his amateur pedigree, but they were still both top-notch fighters. And closer to their primes, Roy won a decision. But it was one of those fights that Roy won the first eight rounds, Hopkins won the last four, but I thought Hopkins did more work in those last four than Roy did in the first eight. Okay, so Roy was undefeated for a long time. He jumped a lot of weight classes, super middleweight, light heavyweight, all the way up to heavyweight, beating John Ruiz. And at the time, he was untouchable. He was a marquee guy on HBO. You know, considered pound for pound the number one fighter in the sport for a number of years, till he lost to Tarver then Glenn Johnson by knockout, then Tarver again by decision where he got beat up pretty good. Then you figure he had that loss to Joe Calzaghe where he got beat up really bad. Then he had three straight losses: a knockout loss to Danny Green, a decision loss to Hopkins, and a devastating knockout to this Dennis Lebedev, I believe his name is. Really, really bad. Okay? Now you got Hopkins. He lost their first fight against Jones, wins the title. You know, he's an alphabet champion. You know, he's, you know, not the top guy of the sport. He's not the marquee name. Even when he was champion, he still wasn't getting all of, like, you know, the big-time fights. But he moved it up. He unified the title. He made 20 successful defenses, breaking Carlos Monzon's record. You know, he was a middleweight champion from 1995 until 2005. Since the Roy Jones fight, which was a close decision, he's never really been beaten. Jermaine Taylor in those two fights, I didn't think won either one of them. I thought Hopkins won the first one. I thought the second was a draw. The fight with Joe Calzaghe, I scored a draw. You know, the guy's never really been beaten. He's 46 years old. He's the oldest man to ever win a world title. You know, he's dominated guys that he really shouldn't have. So, just for example, say, in 2016, let's welcome both Roy Jones and Bernard Hopkins to the Hall of Fame. Who gets the top billing?
Is there even such a thing, though, as top billing?
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, it's not like an intentional thing. But you look at it this way. We got the Hall of Fame coming up in what, next weekend, isn't it? So you got the Hall of Fame coming up next weekend, and you're going to have guys coming in from your, you know, your old-timers, and most of these guys, your old-timers, and these are guys from 1950 and before, 1960 and before, your old-timers, quote-unquote, in the years from, like, the 1800s or whatever. Then you have more of your modern guys. Now, this year, some of the guys that are going in, Julio Cesar Chavez, Ricardo Lopez, Sylvester Stallone's going at school and everything. Who is going to be the final guy introduced? You know it's going to be Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
You know Mike Tyson is going to get the thing this year.
I don't know if he's going to be
the final. So that's my question, is if Hopkins and Jones going on the same year, who gets the top billing? Who was the last one introduced?
I think it should be Bernard. Just my personal preference. But who knows? Speaking of a guy who's old and still fighting, I do want to update the Tony Tubbs situation. He had his... I guess he hasn't fought yet. He was supposed to fight. He hasn't fought yet. He did fight, though, in 2006. I didn't realize that. His last fight was in 2006. It was Adam Smith. But there was a story going around that he was going to have another fight. He was going to be the oldest active heavyweight. I haven't seen that. But yeah, I think... Bernard should be a top billing, for sure. To me, he's just a much better legacy type guy. And I think it's important that when you choose to leave the sport, it's, you know, it's a character thing, and it's also a skill thing. If you're leaving because, you know, you're on the top of your game, got nothing left to give to the sport or no goal left to reach, I think that's more admirable than you're only leaving because you got your head smashed into it. And you're only still fighting because you need the money. You know, it's just, I understand that's, you know, the boxer's plight, but in a lot of situations, but at the same time, it just becomes sort of you know, less impressive that a guy just stays in there because he needs the money. Friday night fights this weekend. We got a heavyweight contest between Tony Thompson, 35-2 with 23 knockouts, and Maurice Harris, 24-14 with two draws, 10 knockouts. Chris Areola's fighting Kendrick Rawford on that card. I thought it's for sure Chris Areola that just fought. Maybe I'm wrong. Let me check his record. I swear, I thought he just fought like a few weeks ago. Yeah, he just fought May 14th. It was a quick one, though. Against Nagy Aguilera, who's 16-5. He knocked him out in the third round. So, wow. That's a pretty quick turnaround. 2 weeks later. Fighting on ESPN 2 Friday Night Fights. He's 31-2 with 27 knockouts, also a heavyweight. He's fighting a 10-rounder against Kendrick Rawford, who's 22-14 with two draws, 10 knockouts. Tyrone Brunson fighting at middleweight on that card. He's 21-1, 20 knockouts, one draw, fighting a real tough dude by the initials of TBA. With no record visible. What to be announced. That's about it for that impressive card. No titles on that card. A lot of good fights. That's going to be in the Reno, Nevada, the Reno Event Center tomorrow night. Let's see what else we got. Any other big fights from last week that I failed to mention?
Chad Dawson fight, you know, now because he's going to be fighting Hopkins next. I would really like to see that fight end up in Atlantic City.
Some controversy there too, because now they're saying that they want Hopkins to fight Lucien Boutte and rip up the contract. And we actually posted a blog from the Dawson camp, kind of putting it out there, like, I know you're a man of your word, Bernard. Let's not screw me. Let's make this happen as soon as possible. You promised me this fight. So there must be some kind of a plan to at least look at not following through with the Dawson fight. So maybe the Iceman will shed some light on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd definitely talk to him about it, see what his opinions are. But the one thing Emmanuel Stewart said was after the fight, he's like, maybe the fight can end up in Montreal. You know, this is like the new hotbed for light heavyweight boxing. No, it's not. It's a hotbed because John Pascal was fighting there. He was selling the place out because he was a big name there. You put Bernard Hopkins and Chad Dawson there, yeah, you might get a quarter of a crowd. Only way you'd get anybody there is you put Pascal on the undercard. You put him, you know, against whoever. Put him against, you know, some 90-year-old grandmother and say the winner gets the title shot. Then people would come to see Pascal, and then they'd probably leave before the main event. Here's what I would like to see, mainly because I'm greedy. I would like to see the Hopkins-Dawson fight end up in Atlantic City because you figure Dawson's from Hartford, Connecticut. Hopkins is from Philadelphia. That's a meeting ground kind of right, you know, similar to the middle. Let us, you know, East Coasters, you know, get a chance to see a good live title fight.
All right. Why not just have it in Philadelphia?
We could. I wouldn't complain about that.
I'm trying to find some other interesting fights this weekend. Nothing's really jumping out at me. Stuff going on in South Africa, the Dominican Republic, but no real big title fights. Nothing on HBO or Showtime that I see here. Unfortunately. That's about it. We do have some news here on some of the other fights on next Strikeforce card, which is going to see Alistair Overeem versus Fabricio Werdum in the Strikeforce heavyweight tournament. Lightweight fighters are just recently, a couple of lightweight fights were added. Jesus, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Casillas, Jay-Z, I guess they call him, Cavalcante. Is fighting Justin the Silverback Gorilla Wilcox. Fighting also Connor Hewn facing Magno Almeida. And the heavyweight Grand Prix quarterfinal between reigning Strikeforce champion Alistair Overeem and Pride Fighting Championship rival Fabricio Werdum. It's obviously the main event. Also, the other quarterfinal bout between Josh Barnett and Brett Rogers. And Gina Carano is going to be returning to the cage against Sarah DiAlelio in a 145-pound fight. Daniel Cormier is fighting Jeff the Snowman Monson. Valentin Overeem, Alistair's brother, is going to be facing Chad Griggs. And on the undercard, we got KJ Nunes taking on Jorge Masvidal. That's for a shot at Gilbert Melendez, his lightweight title. Also, there's going to be another women's fight with Amanda Nunes and Julie Kedzie. Julie actually has already fought Gina. I think that was one of the first, if not the first, televised female MMA fight when they first went on Showtime there. If I remember correctly, that was a good fight. Also, pretty interesting news here. Sad news. We lost a big-time legend in the wrestling world last week, Randy the Macho Man Savage.
Yes,
snapping into a heavenly slim gym. 58 years old. The first report that I saw was something to the effect that seemed like he had some kind of heart attack. Then he went over the median and crashed into a tree. And they came out with an autopsy that was inconclusive as to the cause of death. But it did not include toxicology tests and all that sort of stuff to see if there was anything in his system. Not that it really matters. I mean, it's not like that's a big deal. He's retired. Whatever he's doing, he's doing. But he was in the car with his wife, I think.
Yeah.
Just married his wife. I think they just had their year anniversary. So thank God she didn't get hurt. She was fine. He didn't age well either. Saw a picture of him recently. He just went straight white. Right here.
Yeah. With a big guffy looking beard, you know. But
yeah.
He was always an entertaining one. I read the stories and like some of the other guys, you know, books and everything. The guys that, you know, he got along with, he really got along with. The guys that he didn't get along with, there was some heat. I know he and Hulk Hogan hadn't talked in like 10 years, and they finally reconciled, but just like literally a few months before Randy's death. They said he had a lot of heat with Andre the Giant. Andre, for whatever reason, didn't like him and used to, they'd get in the matches and Andre would just beat the living hell out of him, you know. And it was Andre, he was so big and so strong, you know, he really couldn't do anything bad, at least he just took it.
Well, I thought there was an interesting angle that I had never heard before. I mean, that's actually one of the periods when Hulk and Macho Man were still going in wrestling. That was the last time I ever really watched it religiously. It was only because one of my friends was a big-time wrestling fanatic. And, of course, he had Miss Elizabeth as his on- and off-stage partner at that time. And I didn't realize this, but there was a piece of news in one of the articles about his death that talked about how she left him for some other big-time wrestler. Yeah. And she ended up dying of an overdose at his house.
Yeah. and you want to hear, and you hate to say this, because both stories are, you know, equally sad and tragic. With most of these entertainers, I mean, especially the non-wrestling ones, it's hard to really know, you know, more about them because you don't know, you know, about their physical limitations and their mental limitations. Now, when Elizabeth died back in 2003 with Lex Luger, she had died with a combination of oxycontins and vodka. Now, she obviously wasn't an active wrestler, so you don't know why she's taking, you know, prescription pain medicines like oxycontins. So, and you never would see her as much as, you know, a lot of times you'll see wrestlers, you know, guys that have injuries or guys that are having problems, and they're popping, you know, pills to get through it, and then they're mixing it with alcohol, and then they were doing steroids. But two situations completely separate from each other. Elizabeth left Randy Savage, you know, and, you know, went on with Lex Luger. Lex, I'm not saying that if Elizabeth stayed with Randy Savage, everything would have been all peachy keen and perfect and everything. But with Lex, who was obviously well known for his steroid use and, you know, maybe some other illegal activities, they had tons of human growth hormones, Oxycontin. So Elizabeth, by leaving Randy Macho Man Savage, ends up going to a guy, and she ends up dying with him. And another completely separate situation, there was a wrestler, Kevin Sullivan, whose wife was Nancy Sullivan. She left him in a wrestling angle for Chris Benoit, and then ended up leaving him in real life for Chris Benoit. And then years later, Chris ended up murdering her and their son.
I didn't know that either.
Oh, you didn't know that? That was like 4 years ago. Chris Benoit, who was a wrestler, and, you know, he
well,
was...
Well, I know that story of what happened to Chris Benoit, but I didn't know the...
Okay.
Yeah,
his wife had left another wrestler, Kevin Sullivan, for him, and it was first they started with part of an angle, and then it happened, you know, for real.
Talk about art imitating life. That's the definition.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, Triple H, how he's married to Vince McMahon's daughter.
Right.
Triple H was engaged to China. You know, Joni Lauer. They were engaged. They were pretty much, you know, living together, and they were doing an angle on wrestling where, you know, Triple H, you know, broke Stephanie and her fiance up. And then he, like, fake married her, but it wasn't a fake marriage. She was really in on it, and she turned bad or whatever. So all the weeks they're coming out, like, they'd all be out there, and Triple H would be sitting down, and she'd be sitting on his lap. Next thing you know, he's really banging her in real life. China's out the door. He's marrying her, and now he's got, like, three kids with her.
Yeah, that's tough to break up with the boss's daughter.
Yeah, break up with the boss's daughter.
I got a buddy from college that ended up marrying the boss's daughter, and he's stuck. There's no going anywhere for him. Not to mention he does have some kids with her. But it's a rocky relationship. Anyway, I do want to touch on a couple other stories in MMA before we get the boxing conversation really going here with Mr. Iceman, John Scully. We had a big-time, big high-profile retirement. Murillo Ninja Hua retired from MMA over the last week. Had a particularly rough fight against Tom Kong Watson in a circuit called Bama, or Bama 6, on last Saturday. He lost to Tom Watson. And, of course, as fighters often do now, especially MMA guys, he broke the news on Twitter. And he wrote, "Congratulations to my opponent, Tom Watson, on the victory tonight. He was better and deserved. I would like to announce officially my retirement from pro MMA fights tonight. It was an amazing run, and it's a very tough moment, but there comes a time for all in life, and it's time to move on. I'm proud of all I did in MMA and all experiences I had. I will continue to work with MMA, doing seminars, teaching classes, training fighters, and doing my share to help our sport that I love so much. Maybe he'll get an office next to Chuck Liddell. Who knows? Become a UFC executive. Also, Nick Diaz is not fighting in a boxing match next. But there's also talk that he's not fighting George St. Pierre next, or at least not on December 10th in Montreal, Quebec. Dana White came out recently and said that fight is not a done deal, not even close. All that stuff that's out there about that meeting that we had here is BS. But Jeff Lacy and Nick Diaz will not be fighting. And his camp had said, when Jeff Lacy came out and said that he had signed that contract, that only a big money MMA deal or bout could deter his boxing ambition. So, looks like that's what happened. And also, quickly, we did have another episode of The Ultimate Fighter last night. And a local guy from my old neck of the woods, used to live in Weymouth, Massachusetts, right next to a town called Rockland. And that's where Chuck Cold Steel O'Neill lives right now. And he had a very good fight against a guy that he had lost to. And they gave him another chance, came back, and just ripped him up. Actually got him, beat him up so bad, the kid he fought is not allowed to fight again, period. He scratched his corneas, both of them, with some punching. And ironically, the kid that had beat him earlier, he beat him by his own submission. He liked to do the triangle choke. So the kid was a lot better wrestler and submission artist going into that fight. And he decided consciously that he was going to go with the striking for this fight. He wanted to prove something to Dana White. And all he proved that he could end up in the hospital to fight by his game plan. The other fight was very quick. It was a guy named Ryan McGilvery versus Tony Gonzalez. And the night after those two fights, they got to have their major drunken scene where they all get out of control and drink up a storm and something stupid happens. While they haven't been really destroying the house like they have in past years, this was pretty close. I mean, they destroyed the good vibes, I guess, in the house when one of their antics got serious. One guy poured water on another guy's head. And the guy that won his fight by knockout, Tony there, he ended up just getting into a hell of a free-for-all fight with another guy that's not in the mix for the championship. And it was bad. It got to the point where after they went over the couch and Tony hit his head off the glass on the couch, he got back up and he put his elbow in the guy's neck, and then of course the guys realized it was serious and they tried to separate him. And then all of a sudden we had a situation where one of the fighters had lost custody of his kid, his son. And it's Tony Gonzalez is pointing at him going, "Where's your son? Where's your son?" You know? Getting all personal for no reason and just trying to rile the guy up. And then they separate him and they keep trying to tell this kid, you know, shut up. It has nothing to do with it. Why don't you cool off, calm down, or whatever. So they separate him for a while. The kid that said this shit about the guy's son goes out and just jumps in the pool for a while. Then he comes back in the house. And they go at it again. It's like, you shouldn't have said that. And so he says it again. To the point where even the guy's own friends, it looked like they hate him now. And they showed pieces of the next episode where everybody's just giving him the cold shoulder the next day. So I'm sure it's going to get a little interesting. And one of his best friends in the house has to fight him now, this Chuck O'Neill. So he's even saying, "I'm going to destroy his dreams." So hopefully the hometown kid from my old stomping grounds gets the job done. So I'm really going to like to see that. There's just no call for that kind of crap. Just goes to show you, they shouldn't even allow alcohol in the house. Because it just gets to that point. One of these times, somebody's going to get sued.
I mean, you're training for an athletic competition. I mean, I personally don't think that, you know, gives off a very good impression. I mean, I don't watch the show, to be totally honest,
But, I mean, you're dealing with a thing where you're training to fight. You're really going to be in, you know, the best possible shape and, you know, to really make an impact. And when you're showing like this, I mean, sophomoric behavior, you know, it's not a good role model. I mean, you got a lot of these younger guys, you know, watching the show now, and, you know, they're getting all pumped up into it and everything. And then you're showing like the antics like that. When they showed The Contender, now The Contender, you know, the first season did really well. You never really saw the guys out there really drinking and boozing it up. They were trained. You'd see, like, some guys even having trouble making weight. I remember the one year, I think it was, like, Jesse Brinkley was killing himself to make weight. But you had, like, these guys, a lot of them, you know, showing, like, some of their diets and everything, you know, trying to, you know, keep in shape. I don't think what the Ultimate Fighter is doing with the glamorizing of these guys, you know, poor behavior, being piss poor role models, is not good for the sport in the long run.
Right.
But what happens when you tolerate it?
It's a bad example to be setting.
Yeah, it is.
You know, you want people to see. The idea of the whole show is you want people to see what it takes to be a fighter. You know?
Yeah, not, you know, hey, shit, you know, anybody can drink and goof off and, you know, have a poor diet and anything like that and then get in the ring and fight. I mean, but you're not going to be at optimal level. I mean, look at a guy like Lixon, Bernard Hopkins. Would he tolerate that shit? No way.
And I don't think Rampage Jackson was on The Ultimate Fighter. I could be wrong, but, you know, it just goes to show you what kind of mentality these guys have, you know, even when they're seasoned athletes and professionals in the sport. When he goes on a late night show and all he's talking about is drinking after the fight, you know, win or lose, I'm going to get drunk. You know, which is his prerogative, but, you know, you don't want to be giving kids that that persona in public. You know, that's what these fighters do. They just fight and drink. So I think it's just a bad move on their part. I know that Dana White's, you know, Mr. F-Bomb doesn't really care about what people think about him or the sport. He just he laughs at everybody's face and does his own thing. But there's going to be a point at which, you know, the people like the legislators in New York who are against the sport are going to look like they're in the right because his attitude representing the whole entire sport, and it's the UFC's general attitude towards stuff like this. You know, it's bad enough that people are coming up with all these misconceptions about what MMA is and, you know, how dangerous it might be, or, you know, whatever they come up with to deny it access to certain states like New York. But when you have concrete examples of what kind of behavior they're fostering like this, it's just ridiculous. It's like, you know, they're putting the ratings and drama above the possible or the best positive example that they could set. And it's just unfortunate to see that, you know, and to know that show has a very large following of young, impressionable people. It just makes it even worse. And I know John Scully actually just put out something recently on Facebook about how irresponsible it is to drink to that point.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Let's get him on the phone and get back to boxing.
Absolutely.
Here we go, Mr. Scotty. Gonna have my weekly rant against the UFC.
Hello?
John, how's it going?
That depends. Who's this?
This is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron.
How you guys doing?
Good.
All right.
So
I'm ready.
What's new these days out there in Connecticut?
Actually, I'm just leaving the gym. We had a real late night in the gym. You know, getting guys to have a big amateur show here next Saturday. So we're getting ready for that. And have Mike Oliver training. There's a good chance he's going to fight for the WBO title against Orlando Salido in Mexico in July. So we're waiting for confirmation on that.
Cool. We also got our...
Orlando's coming off that big win over Juan Manuel Lopez. And, you know,
I mean, we, you know, at this level, that's the name of the game, fighting that quality of guy. And, you know, depending how you look at it, fortunately or unfortunately, but if you want the title, you got to fight somebody like that. So, you know, that's what we're going to do.
Absolutely. I mean, if you want to be the best, I mean, I think Ric Flair said it better than anybody. To be the man, you got to beat the man.
And I don't like when you see people, you know, they purposely chew the perceived weakest champion. You know, I could see, like, beforehand being excited about that. But then when you win it and you realize that there's another champion out there that's much more respected than you are, you know, I would think your ultimate goal would be to beat the person that's most respected. And Salido, after that win, I mean, he's certainly more than worthy. So, you know, if we win, we'll be able to say we beat a great fighter. And if we don't, we'll be able to say at least we tried to beat a great fighter.
Right. I mean, I've followed Orlando Salido for a few years. He has a win over a guy that I used to train with, Rogers Matagua. He beat Rogers a couple years ago. I think he ended up broke his ribs or something. It was a stoppage. Stoppage win. And Rogers is a tough kid, and you know that just showed me right there that this Toledo, you know, he is the real deal. And beating a guy like Juan Manuel Lopez, I mean, shows you right there that he is one of the top guys in that division.
Right.
You gotta watch out for the juice with him, though. He had a little steroid slap a little while back, didn't he?
I'm not even sure. The truth.
I'll certainly
be looking into that.
It was years ago. He actually beat Robert Guerrero, I think. And he came back.
That's right. I think it was a no contest.
Yeah. And I think I heard his excuse was something to the effect that he'd been eating a lot of steak, and wherever he lives in Mexico, they give the cattle a lot of steroids, so he was saying it was from the steak that he was eating. I don't know if that's a valid excuse, but he got tagged. They took the fight off the books. And nothing's ever happened since then with him, so I guess he learned his lesson. Just thought I'd mention that. what's going on with Bad Chad? Bernard or what?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm assuming that's going to be his next fight, and. You know, that's what I think the division definitely needs is that at this point. You know, unfortunately, it's not amazingly, you know, with Bernard, like, in the mix, it becomes interesting, especially with what he's doing. If Bernard were to retire right now and leave the light heavyweight division as it is, you know, it's just not that there aren't good fighters in it, but there's not stars. So I think Chad needs the Bernard Hopkins in there to really make a name for himself in trying to get the title.
John, the one thing I said watching the fights last week, and it was I think it was Emmanuel Stewart that said it, and I personally disagreed with him, that they they're like, oh, but they should set this fight off in Montreal because that's a new hotbed for light heavyweight boxing. And, yeah, the crowds up there have been impressive recently, but that's because Jean Pascal was main eventing, and he is, you know, very widely popular up there. I don't think a Bernard Hopkins-Chad Dawson fight as your main event would draw, you know, obviously not as well as Pascal did up there. I mean, they'd have to put him on the undercard. But personally, I wouldn't mind seeing, maybe this is because I'm a fan and I'd like to go to fights, I wouldn't mind seeing that fall on the East Coast, maybe Atlantic City, because you got Chad Dawson who's from Hartford, which that's only you know, a few hours' drive. Bernard Hopkins from Philadelphia, that's only an hour and a half drive. I think I could draw really well at, you know, the boardwalk call down there.
Well, listen, I'm actually surprised, and I don't know if he was taken out of context, but I'm surprised Emmanuel would think that, because I don't think Chad and Hopkins does anything in Montreal. I don't think anybody would care about that fight. You know, they care only because they're fighting Pascal and Diacano. That's why they care. You know, so, yeah, that's kind of an odd statement. You know, I would imagine the fight should, you know, you would think it would be an East Coast fight. I mean, but, you know, boxing is crazy. I mean, I can remember one time, I forget who it was, but it was two guys from, you know, whatever state they were from, and the fight was in Las Vegas. You know, like two guys from Detroit or something, and they fought in Las Vegas. So I don't know how that worked out. But, you know, you would think Atlantic City or Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun would want to pick the fight up. And, but Canada, I don't see that at all.
Yeah, I don't see that being a good drop in Canada. John, another question I was going to ask you, I actually said this to Rich, you know, before we got you on the phone tonight. I went to a fight card a little over a year ago. It was about a week or so after the Hopkins Roy Jones rematch. It wasn't a great fight. Hopkins, you know, Jones looked shop worn, and Hopkins didn't look, you know, all that great. But he won the fight. And I went to a friend of mine who's a very well known in the sport of boxing. You might even know him, George Hanson. They all call him Chicken.
Yeah.
He's a Philadelphia guy. Yeah, George. Me and him are both from the same old school gym. So I've known him for 15, 16 years. And I went up to him and I said, George, let me ask your opinion on this. And this was a year ago. And I said, if Roy and Bernard both decide to retire after their fight April 3rd, 2010, and they both are first ballot Hall of Famers and they go in on the same year, who would get, like the top billing, which would be, like, the guy that is the last one introduced? And we looked at, because both guys had compelling arguments. Roy, when his star was shining, there was no star that was brighter. Hopkins maybe wasn't as bright, but it had more longevity. And now you look at it a year later, they both fight on the same day. Hopkins becomes the oldest fighter in history to win a world title, and Roy has a very devastating loss. If they both decide to retire right now, and in 5 years they both go in the Hall of Fame on the same day, who do you think will get the top billing?
I mean, I think people remember the way things ended up, and, you know, I think, like, right now, today, Hopkins is bigger, and, you know, obviously he's considered by a lot of people greater and everything, but I think, you know, if you go prime for prime, I think, just like Roy's song, you know, like what he said, you all must have forgot. I mean, this guy, they forget what he was in his best day, and I hope, you know, I think it's a shame that people forget, because now it's almost become, in many ways it has become a joke where people make fun of Roy, like how he got knocked out, and, oh, the, you know, what was better, the Johnson knockout or this knockout, you know, and things like that, and, you know, they forget in his prime, on his best day. I mean, this guy was a phenomenon, and I don't think there's any comparison between the two. I mean, Bernard is, you know, a lot of people talk about he's old school and he's this and that, but, I mean, I don't think, personally, for my taste, I mean, you know, the headbutting and the, you know, the dirty tricks and the, you know, the inside things and all that. You know, I don't necessarily consider that old school. You know, it's like crafty stuff that you can get away with. But, you know, I mean, Roy Jones, if I could have somebody's skills, I would take Roy Jones over Bernard any day of the week. And, you know, I think history, a lot of the purists, I think they might go with Hopkins. But for me, I mean, I would judge it by, if you take both guys on their best day, of popularity and excitement and everything, and put them on opposite sides of the street and tell a group of people you can only go see one guy, you can only go shake one of their hands, you know, I think more people would go see Roy Jones than would go see Bernard Hopkins.
And then that's exactly the type of, because that's, and that was even telling Rich, one of the reasons I like having you on our show is because we get to talk about a lot of more in-depth things. And I always like to give you good questions like that, because I always like your answers.
Thank you.
I was joking around with a gentleman. He's a he was a former Philadelphia newscaster, and he actually emailed me on Facebook, showing me through some mutual friends, and he says, you know, he found a guy that in me that is like a Philadelphia sports fan with the Eagles and the Phillies and all that, but also a big time fight fan, and he does some commentary now for boxing. So I started throwing all these, like, he just emailed me like, hey, nice to meet you. I'd like to be friend request on here. Next thing I know, I'm emailing this guy back like, yo, tell me about your favorite fighters and tell me about this. I'm like, I almost get like a little kid when it comes to like talking about boxing, just because I love it so much. And anytime I can talk to anybody that has any knowledge about the sport, it's like a Christmas morning to me.
That's the way it should be.
Now, John, can you give us a little bit of a rundown of your background in the sport for any of the few people who don't know who you are out there from when you started till now?
Well, I started boxing in, actually, my first day in the gym was 1982, and I boxed amateur until 88, and I was bronze medalist at the Olympic trials, the 165-pound division. Then I was there with Roy Jones and Gerald McClellan, and actually Gerald didn't make the Olympic trials, but, you know, Michael Moore and all those great fighters, and I turned pro in 88, and I guess most people know me from my fight with Michael Nunn. I guess that's the one that I get the most emails about. 1995, we fought for the North America title. It was a pretty good fight. They show it on ESPN Classic sometimes. And then I fought for the world title against Henry Maske in Germany in 1996. And my last fight was in 2001. And then I concentrated fully on training fighters. And I've been lucky enough to train some people you might have, you know, average fly-by-night fans even would have heard of. Obviously, Chad Dawson and Jose Rivera, who we won the WBA junior middleweight title together, and Mike Oliver, and I briefly trained Ray Oliveira and Scott Pemberton, and Matt Rumelard. I had a hand in his training. And that's what I'm still doing now. I train boxers, amateur and pro, and I'm doing some work occasionally for ESPN. I've been on a lot of the fights I've done with ESPN Classic are still aired on a weekly basis. And so for some of the big fights, I do a live segment with ESPN News. The last one I did was Mayweather and Mosley. And so I'm kind of an all-around boxing guy. I get my hand in as many areas as possible.
Yeah, you got to be a good go-to guy for them living in Connecticut. You know, they're right there. It's Bristol, right?
Yeah. It's a lucky thing. Well, I've actually known Joe Testor for many years. He was I actually knew him well before he became an ESPN broadcaster, because he was working for Channel 3 here in Hartford. He was a local TV newscaster. And so when he actually was working on auditioning for the ESPN spot, him and I actually talked quite a bit, and I kind of helped prep him, I guess you'd say, for his auditions. And so now, you know, having that connection is, obviously hasn't hurt me in the subsequent years. So I've been lucky enough to be on ESPN quite a few times, and the fact that they're not that far away from me is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, funny story about Joe Tessitore. The first time I ever heard his voice, it was actually on a video game. It was like a baseball game, and he was playing the announcer, obviously, and his name as the announcer was Jim Short. So next time, see if you're...
Yeah, I guess he's on the fight night too. It's funny, all my stepson's friends, they all know him because of the fight night game. He's the broadcaster on there. So it's amazing what the how people get to be famous in certain areas. And the kids today, they know him because of that. Even the kids that don't watch boxing.
And what do you think about the sport of boxing these days? What about the last time I think we had you on, we were going the whole mixed martial arts versus boxing debate, that sort of thing. How do you think it's fared since then against MMA, and what do you think about its future right now?
Well, I think, and it's a good thing that we have, it's good and bad that Mayweather and Pacquiao are going through their, you know, whatever it is they're going through. You know, they're making each other aware of each other, and the average fans are starting to question if that fight's going to happen. So that's a positive thing, even though it's becoming frustrating because it's not happening. But also I think the Super Six is getting people talking. I'm actually surprised how many people that didn't know who Andre Ward was a year ago. Now they, you know, they're really touting him in a big way. So, you know, we need that exposure, you know, and hopefully we can maintain it. But, you know, hopefully boxing will persevere as it always has. You know, we just got to keep plugging it, keep making these big fights. And I think, I mean, a lot is going to depend on Mayweather and Pacquiao. I mean, people ask me, it's amazing that people are even asking, are they going to fight? I mean, it just boggles my mind that they might not, that it's even considered. I mean, they have to fight, and it'll be. I didn't used to think so, but now with all the hype, I mean, it'll easily be the biggest fight of all time. Obviously, maybe not historically, but certainly money wise, it'll be the biggest fight ever.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. A lot of the sportscasters, even I think Teddy Atlas mentioned it when I talked to him. We had an interview with him a little while back. That you know, Floyd needs money for lawyers. You know, a lot of people don't talk about that aspect of it. That there's a lawsuit going on between the two. Number one, and that you know, even though Floyd has a ton of money probably saved up, and he's living in $1 million, you know, multi-million-dollar house, he is going to have a lot of mounting legal fees with all this stuff going on. And if he should happen to lose one of these big cases, that'd be even worse. You know, because I'm sure a guy like Manny Pacquiao has the savings to go toe to toe with him in court for as long as he wants to. But also, I know that Floyd's come out and said that because of that lawsuit, there's no way they're going to fight. You know, the performance enhancing drug allegations, that thing. So I think that's going to play a bigger role than a lot of people think, the whole legal situation. But some people say the legal bills are actually going to force Floyd to fight, but it may not be Manny because of that situation. So I think that's actually handcuffing him more than anything else. But I do want to see that fight. It just seems like it's the more that whole saga goes on, the farther fetched it is. What's your take?
It would be criminal for me if the fight doesn't happen. That would be just mind-boggling. You know, I can't imagine that, you know, when Leonard and Hearns were both coming up as welterweights, I mean, there was no question they were going to fight each other. It was very clear, and they did. And when Trinidad and De La Hoya, you know, there was no question they were going to fight each other. And Holmes and Cooney, I mean, certain fights are just, they have to be made. And, you know, I mean, I hope they get everything straightened out. But also, on you know, I guess it's good for the fans, but Floyd also has tax trouble, which, you know, apparently many say is going to force him to fight so he can rectify the problems with the IRS. But, you know, I just want to see him at his best. You know, I don't want to have it be where he takes so much time off that, you know, if he doesn't look good and they'll say it's only because he had a layoff. I mean, the boxing fans deserve to see this fight.
Yeah, hopefully. We'll see it. It's also kind of encouraging to see that we have now Manny Pacquiao trying to make a fight with Juan Manuel Marquez, and those are the same camps that would have to get together, Golden Boy and Bob Arum, to make the Floyd fight. So I think if one fight happens, the next is not too far off. So hopefully that happens.
Right.
Well, John, two of the points that I wanted to bring up. One was I had a chance to answer the questions you had put out about a week or so ago. One was about the Super Six, and in my answer, I picked Andre Ward to win. I had followed him. I said, "What's a shame about, you know, the coverage for Olympic boxing now is it's not as it was." I think the last year that really got good coverage, at least in Ring Magazine was 1996. I remember reading about guys like Floyd Mayweather, Antonio Tarver, David Reed, Fernando Vargas, and not much in 2000 or 2004, 2008. But I remember reading a lot about Andre Ward coming up. You know, he was undefeated, you know, for how many years as an amateur, won the gold medal, undefeated as a pro. He looks like he's got all the skills in the world, and that's why I'm picking him to win. I think the Frotch-Glenn Johnson fight is going to be excellent because of their styles. I think just Frotch's advantage in youth, and he's just a little bit more spry, is going to pull him to a tough decision win. But I think Frotch is a little bit – he's going to put pressure on Ward, which I like, because that's what I want to see. I want to see how Andre Ward reacts when he really gets stunned in a fight or gets cut or something's not going his way. I said it in my response, he's a high-character guy, and I think he's going to have the mental makeup, kind of like a young Sugar Ray Leonard, to fight through that, but I want to see it. But that's why I'm picking Andre Ward to win this one. With regards to Pacquiao and Mayweather, I'm a fan more than anything. You know, I want to see that fight, and because it's interesting, and I remember saying a few months ago, and people asked me, do you think it'll happen? And I was very skeptical, and I said, well, both fighters have a lot to lose, and I don't know if they think they have enough to gain. Because you take a guy like Floyd Mayweather, he's undefeated, he's 41-0. He claims to be the best ever. I don't agree with him, but I do respect him as a very talented, top-notch fighter. And I think, you know, he's kind of afraid to risk that, because if he loses, you know, I don't know if he wants to make that gamble. I mean, it's easy for him to gamble $50,000 on the Bulls heat, but I don't know if he wants to make that gamble with himself. And Pacquiao is an icon in his home country. I mean, if he loses, I mean, that could theoretically crush an entire nation. But I would like to see it happen. And I was actually talking to Al Bernstein a few months ago. We had him on our show. And Al and I were throwing some ideas out at each other. And you know, one thing I said to Al, I said, in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, every day that passes, I think the hourglass tilts a little bit more towards Pacquiao. I said, Mayweather is a guy that does a lot off speed, timing, and rhythm. And I said, look at Roy Jones. I said, Roy Jones, when he lost just a shade, you know, his chin was, you know, that you find out where his weakness was. And I said, Floyd could be theoretically easier to hit, and who knows what he has in that chin. We've only ever seen him really get stunned once. And then on the other hand, I said, I think Freddie Roach has done such an excellent job with Manny Pacquiao that he teaches him something new every day and makes him better. Manny Pacquiao, just a couple of years ago, was a one-handed fighter. Now he's got a very devastating right hand and sets up that left. I am not a big fan of, and Rich will tell you, of the Mayweathers as trainers. Because a lot of times I don't see them really teaching or strategizing things. So we, come on, you're better than that. Come on, don't let this bum beat you. Come on, you can do better than that. Come on. And I see more cheerleading than anything. I mean, you could put my mother in Floyd Jr.'s corner, and he'd still be a great fighter. I just think the hourglass is tilting more towards Pacquiao. What do you think?
Well, I mean, yeah, certainly that, you know, the Pacquiao has momentum, and he's just maintaining it. And Mayweather, if anything, I think his momentum is dwindling, and he, you know, he's losing it. And I think he's probably, I think he's a guy that he strikes me as a guy that cares what people think and say, and I'm sure in his circle, he's starting to hear doubts. Maybe even friends of his might be saying, come on, man, we know what's going on. You're going to fight this guy or what? Like, are you scared? I mean, what is it? You know, because if you don't know better, if you don't know the guy, you'd say he was intimidated. You know, I don't like to think that about a fighter. I mean, Floyd's a great fighter, and, you know, I tend to think there's another reason, whether it's the lawsuit or whatever it is. But, you know, after a while, it's like, man, you just apparently don't want to fight this guy. And I think you're very right as far as I think Mayweather wants to stay undefeated. And if that means not fighting the guy and letting people wonder what would have happened, I think he'd be he'd rather have that than actually go through the fight and lose. I find it hard to believe. It would be amazing to me if this fight is not put together. I mean, for that kind of money, the people that are in charge of putting it together, just how they would not do everything in their power to force the fight to happen. And also, like you mentioned about with Mayweather, I mean, the thing is for me, training Mayweather, obviously, whoever trained him did a great job with him. But to say you're the best trainer and you're the brilliant, super awesome trainer, why don't you have 5 or 6 Floyd Mayweathers running around? How come you don't just, quadruple your money earnings by churning out all these other great fighters and have them make big money too? So, I know a particular fighter who trains with Floyd Senior, and he told me that he didn't really think Floyd Senior was that good of a trainer, and they don't train together anymore. So it's all relative. I'd like to see someone train someone other than Floyd Mayweather and see how they do with them before they claim that they're the best.
Well, here was my point of argument. He took Floyd Senior took over Oscar De La Hoya back, about 10 or so years ago. And Oscar always had the penchant of saying no matter who was training him was the best trainer in the world and was teaching him new things.
Oh, and I thought he looked worse with Floyd.
That's what I was going to say. And the fight that stood out more than anything was the Felix Sturm fight. Oscar was...
Oh, he lost that fight.
He got his ass kicked. He was sitting down on that stool, and you could tell he had, his welts under his eyes, and he was confused. And this guy was sticking him with a jab all day and all night. And you being a trainer, you would know what are you going to say to a guy like that if you're getting beat with a jab? You got to stop the guy from jabbing. You either got to catch it and counter, or you got to take it away from him, or you got to slip it and counter, or beat him to the punch, something. You don't just say, come on, man, come on. This guy's a bum. You're better than that. You ought to be knocking him out. It ain't working.
Right. Yeah, I don't think De La Hoya looked good in general. He didn't look good with me. And people forget that. They forget it. And then, what happened, he promised all these things would happen, and then Hatton got wrecked by Pacquiao. So, again, like, his track record with people other than his son isn't anything more impressive. I could name 5 or 6 trainers who have much deeper resumes than he does.
Yeah, exactly. I was on a conference call a few years ago with Freddie Roach and Floyd Mayweather Sr. leading into the Pacquiao-Hatton fight. And Floyd came out and he said something like, now that Ricky's with me, we're doing all these great things. It's going to be an easy fight. Well, it was an easy fight just for the opposite guy. But he's like saying all these things. And then he came out and said, I always thought Ricky Hatton could easily beat Manny Pacquiao. And then someone asked him, well, if he could easily beat him before, what are you bringing to the table that he needs you so much? And he never had a response because he just tongue-tied himself. Well, if the guy could have beat him easy, does he need you? And then now,
I think
the guy lost, did you make it even worse?
Right. What I think about Floyd is that he's very used to saying these things about himself and nobody questions it. And then when somebody questions it, he gets flustered. He doesn't know what to say. And, it's almost comical to listen to him talk about himself, about what a great trainer he is. And then to see Hatton get beat like that, and then him to not give Freddie Roach any kind of credit or anything like that. So, I know, like, Dan Raphael, he often writes, like, he finds, those guys so entertaining and, but I don't think it's entertaining on 24/7. I think that people are laughing at them. They're laughing at them. Right. You laugh at them. It's entertaining the way, to be honest, everybody has been somewhere and you see a guy on the street and he's obviously a little crazy or something and he's dancing in the street, making faces. And so, everybody stops for a minute and laughs and, they're entertained. I mean, they don't respect the guy in any way. You know, they forget about him as soon as they walk away from him. And you know, that's the kind of vibe I get from people that are into these guys. I mean, the lack of class that they show. You know, recently Roger, I mean, he was talking about Freddie Roach and just very, you know, in very negative terms, and he was insulting the Klitschko's, and he's insulting this one. After a while, it's like, listen, you know, you're not entertaining anymore. You're just a jerk. You're just not a good person. You know, you just talk too much, and you don't have anything to back it up. I mean, once Floyd retires, I don't think you're going to hear much from these guys anymore. I don't think they're gonna produce anybody else.
Well, they're mean spirited, and that's one thing that really bothers me. They're not, and I always look at a guy like Freddie Roach, who was being taught by Eddie Futz. Now, Eddie Futz, one of the greatest gentlemen ever had. The boxing world was privileged to have him. Great trainer, but a better man. And I could never see either Floyd or Roger sitting Joe Frazier on that corner and saying, "Sit down, son. No one will forget what you've done here today."
Right.
They would have probably yanked him off the stool and said, "That guy's a bum."
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you a funny thing, man. Freddie, I don't know Freddie extremely well, but we're both from New England originally. So when I was growing up as an amateur, I knew who the whole Roach family was very well known. Pepper and Freddie, and even their mother was known as a judge. And so I was out in California a few years ago with Matt Godfrey. He had a fight coming up, and so we stopped by the gym. We needed a place to loosen up at. And so I stopped by the Wild Card, and I didn't realize it was, I forget what holiday, but it was a holiday. So one of the guys coming out of the gym, he said, "Oh, man, the gym's closing. It's a holiday. Everybody's leaving early. Nobody's up there except Freddie." And so I said, "Oh, man," I didn't realize it. "Sorry, well, I just want to go up and say hello." And so I said, "Okay, no problem." So I go up, and I say hello to Freddie, and then I say, I ask him if there's a gym around where we could go and loosen up, you know, what gym is open. And he asked me why, and I said, "Oh, you know, the guy's fighting Saturday." And he said, "Oh, no problem." He said, "Look, just come in, do your workout, and, you know, take your time, and when you're done, you know, then we'll leave." So he waited, you know, on the spur of the moment, he waited until we left, until we were done. And then another time I was there, and I'll tell you exactly when it was. It was about 3 weeks before Pacquiao and De La Hoya fought. And we pulled up, and Pacquiao was just leaving. He was in the parking lot, and there was a lot of people around him. So he had just got done training with Freddie upstairs. They did a private training. And then the gym opened after Pacquiao left so everybody else could come. So we go in. And the guy behind the counter didn't know who I was, and he'd asked me questions, and I said, "Oh, you know, we got a fight coming up," and he's like, "Well, you know, you got to pay this amount, and you got to do this." And Freddie came over, and he said, "Oh, no, that's Scully, man, he's good, let him in," and he let me in, he let us train for free, we didn't have to do anything. So we come in, and what I noticed was he had just got done training Pacquiao for the big fight, and there was a kid in the gym. He must have been 10 years old. Couldn't have been over 12, certainly. Probably 10. And Freddie was sitting down at a chair wrapping the kid's hands, right, just for the workout. And I guarantee it was just a kid. It wasn't like a superstar amateur or anything. It was just a 10-year-old kid. And I'm telling you, you're not going to see many multi-million-dollar trainers just get done training a Manny Pacquiao for the De La Hoya fight, and 20 minutes later, they're going to be there wrapping the hands for some 10-year-old kid when there was like six other trainers in the gym that could have done it. And Freddie sat down and wrapped the kid's hands. And that always, you know, I never forgot that. I always remember him doing that.
That's a pretty cool story. And one thing I was going to mention to you, talking about guys that have class, the Freddie Roaches of the world, like I said, he does Eddie Futz proud every day. Do you remember when Roger Mayweather was an active fighter and he fought Vinny Paz, and after he after the fight he punched Lou Dubs in the face?
Oh, I remember very well.
Yeah.
He knocked him down.
Yeah, but Lou got back up.
Yeah, but it was amazing. You know, he hit him hard enough to knock him down, so he didn't push him away. I mean, he threw a punch. He's lucky he didn't kill Lou, you know?
he cut the man's cheek open. Now, you figure if Lou's, you know, close to 90 years old now, and that fight was 20-some years ago, you're talking about a 60-some-year-old man that...
Right, right.
...in the face after a fight. Unprotected.
Right.
And that just, it just says something about a person's character right there. Let me ask you a question, John, as a trainer. You know, you have a lot of fighters that you've been training. Now, let's take Mike Oliver as an example. You're going to take him down to fight Orlando Salido. And say, just going into the fight, you know, you guys are training, and the Salido camp starts accusing your fighter of taking performance-enhancing drugs with no proof. With no proof whatsoever. And, you know, and they're trying to get him to take a test, like a blood test the day before, you know, a fight, or 2 weeks before a fight, when Mike agreed to do it, say, 2 weeks before the fight. As a trainer, as, you know, as a person that, you know, you work hard, too, you know, trying to get this guy ready. I mean, that's not just an insult to Mike Oliver. That's an insult to you. How would you take that, you know, type of insult?
I mean, my whole thing is, it's not up to Mayweather. Like, he has no jurisdiction in my eyes to put a stipulation like that. Like, the commission, like, it's an insult to the commission. Like, he's basically telling the commission, you know, you guys, your stipulations aren't good enough. Like, I want something different. And from what I can see, he has no say. Like under, if there's a, you know, whatever you say, a law or a protocol, I mean, the fight is made. The commission should say, listen, the fight is good. The test is good. We've done the test. This is our test in place. Because all that does is it makes it where, say, hypothetically, you could say Pacquiao, if he wanted to, which he wouldn't. He's not the type of guy, I'm assuming. But say he said, you know what? I've been hearing a lot of talk about Mayweather. He's very promiscuous. He's got a lot of girlfriends. He's got a lot of kids. You know, I've heard that he's got HIV. I've heard he's HIV positive. I want a test done. I want a test done right before the fight because, you know, those tests, you know, they're not accurate unless you're done doing it right before the fight or whatever the case may be. You know, if he ever did something, which he wouldn't do, but if he did, you know, they would say, what, are you crazy? Like, that's, you know, that I've done the required test. I did the required HIV test. But we say, no, we want a more extensive one. We want to make sure. Now, all that does is say, you know, I'm a jerk, mostly, but it's saying, you know, I want everybody to do this. On every fighter could just decide what they want. I want the guy to be tested for this. I want my next one to be tested for that. It's, you know, you've got to go by the commission. Whatever the commission requires, you've got to go by that.
It's funny you mentioned HIV because Manny's actually been out there in the Philippines making headlines because he doesn't want condom use. He wants to ban condoms across the whole Philippines. So I guess it's something to do with his Catholic beliefs. And he said something like, it's in the Bible right there. God says, go out and multiply. But on the flip side of the bad trainer aspect, Freddie Roach is actually making a lot of good waves in the sport recently. The amateurs asked him to come in and work with the amateurs. There's, I don't know if it's HBO or Showtime, but one of the networks there is coming out with a reality show based on him. And it's definitely a good thing. He's even got George St. Pierre working with him in MMA, so he's crossing over to that sport. And just making a heck of a name for himself, and that doesn't happen by accident. So, what would you say are your great strengths out there that would warrant them doing a reality show on you?
What are my strengths as far as being a trainer?
Yeah, I know you actually go there and spar with your guys, right?
I did 6 rounds tonight with one of my amateurs who has a fight next Saturday. I love to spar with the guys just because I can, you know, I can get a sense of, you know, their conditioning and their power and their different aspects of their game. I can tell them what they're really good at and what they need to work on. And, you know, there's no better way than to actually be able to box with them. So I love doing that. But I think, to be honest with you, And it's funny you bring the question up because I was just – the reason I'm getting out of the gym so late is because I was talking to one of the other trainers and we were actually discussing this exact thing where I said, I think one of my best things as a trainer is actually the fact that I used to be a fighter, and I'm able to recognize the expressions and the looks on the faces and the mannerisms of fighters. I can tell, I can read body language of a fighter very well based on my own experiences, and I can tell you what a guy's thinking. I can tell you when he's feeling frustrated, when he's tired, when he's having bouts, you know, the whole nine. And the example I used was a boxer, I assume you know Matt Remillard, the featherweight. He, in his second fight as a pro, he was in the dressing room. We were gloved up and ready to go out, and his head trainer came over to me and he said, Matt's saying his legs are weak. He's feeling kind of weak. What do you think? Can you talk to him? I said, oh, man, no problem. And I went over, and this is exactly what I said. I said, Matt, listen, you've been training for this fight. You train harder than everybody I know. You spar 12 rounds anytime you want. Your legs never become an issue. And now you're going to sit here before the fight and just a fluky thing. You just happen to have a problem with your legs. I said, listen, we don't have time for the nonsense. Now, look, just let's go. Wrap your robe up and let's start going, okay? Just go out and take care of business. And I did that. You know, it's a risky move, but I know how the kid is, and I know how fighters are, and I know how myself is, because I spent years in the gym, in the fights, and that's what a fighter worries about the most on the day of a fight. He's thinking about his legs and how those legs feel, and those legs feel weak, do they feel funny? So based on my previous experience, I knew that's what he was doing. I knew his legs weren't going to be an issue, and they weren't. He stopped the kid in the second or third round. Never once did he mention his legs again for the rest of his career and all the time that I've known him. So I knew it was just a fluky thing, and he needed to be talked to in that manner because we only had a couple minutes leeway. So that was a critical moment, and I feel like that was me at my best. That was me at my best. Like I'm good at that type of that aspect of boxing.
I'll tell you one that really stands out for me a couple years ago was I was a graduate of Lock Haven University. Knew a lot of great guys up there. Dr. Cox, I still go out to see every year. Chuck Masaccio, I actually trained him when he was first starting because I was getting ready to graduate, and I was a assistant trainer at the time because my eligibility was up. And a couple years ago, Lock Haven, for a small school, won the national championship for college boxing, which was a great feat for a school that's going up against like Air Force and Penn State and Navy and Army and all those, you know, military academies. So they win the national title, and a year or so later, I go back up for their annual show, and I didn't obviously know anybody personally on the team anymore. And I see a lot of these guys, they're gloved up, and they're jumping around, and they're having like almost slap fighting contests with each other. And I was like, where's the focus here? And I looked at them, and I didn't know any of these guys, and I kind of felt uncomfortable, you know, going over and saying, yo. So I watched it, and all three of their upper-class fighters, and these guys were seniors. This is the last time you're going to fight in front of your home crowd. My senior year, I was like a caged tiger. You know, I was ready in my eyes. I was focused. I felt great. All three of the senior fighters, the last time in front of their home gym, all got beat. They lost by decision, but it still doesn't matter. They still got their asses kicked. So the next year, I'm talking to Dr. Cox, and he said, yeah, we got a young team this year. It's some new guys. And, you know, and I could just by talking to him on the phone, I was like, boy, he really doesn't seem, you know, very confident with this group. So I emailed the one assistant coach that was helping Coach Cooper out. And I said, listen, I said, I'm going to start my job in a couple weeks. I said, would you guys mind if I came up for a training session one day? They said, no, we'd love to have you. And I got to go to the old gym where I dropped a lot of blood and sweat and tears. And during that time, we used to have just a little small room about the average size of like a master bedroom. That was where we trained, 30 guys sometimes. We were all crammed in there if we had to. I look over there, they're like, oh, yeah, in our locker room now, the ex-president of the college liked boxing. So he gave us the funding to add another room with a full ring in it for sparring. I said, of course. I never had this when I was there. And these young guys weren't even appreciating it. So I go up there, and I'm like, you know, you guys need a little toughness and a little nastiness. And that's why I'm here. So I'm watching the guys, and I'm giving them some advice. And they have one young kid.
and he was irking me from the start. And he was getting there, and he was hitting the bag a little bit, and he was like, making sure nobody was looking. After about 30 seconds, he would just stop, lean, look around, just, you know, drop his arms, take a few breaths. I hit the bag for another 5-10 punches. Then he'd walk around the bag a few times. And I pulled him aside. I said, you know, I said, I'm watching you. I said, when you work with me, I said, I might only be here to just today. But for today, you will go 3 minutes hard. And I busted his ass hard. And then I go up to the show a couple weeks later. He went back to his bad habits. And he fought a kid from, you know, it might have been Navy or Penn State. I don't remember. But his conditioning let him down, and then he quit, which irked me more than anything because I read your article, Don't Stop the Fight, and I still have it.
And
that's kind of the same mentality I always had. You know, no matter what, I can get through it. Don't stop.
Right.
And it was just, you know what? I'm tired. That's all I got. And I'm like, because you didn't work hard enough. And that just, it just irked me. It still irks me. And then he ended up getting a shot to go to regionals because, he ended up having a decent win or two. Goes to regionals, and now you're fighting top quality again. Pulled another quit job. And I'm like, Doc, if you took him off the team, you know, you got to figure out something to do with this kid because he ain't got it on his left side.
Right,
right. I said, I wouldn't waste my time.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you know, some guys just don't. They just, you know, you can give them a chance and you can try and build them up and make them see, but some guys, you know, they just don't get it. They'll never get it. And they'll, you know, sometimes they have to be 40 before they look back on it and realize, you know, hindsight, what they can see clearly. But yeah, it's frustrating. That's why, you know, especially being an amateur coach, you have to deal with so many different personalities. And you know, some of the kids are just talented, but they don't want to work. And some of the guys, it's funny, it's almost like some of the guys that are the most talented have the least amount of desire, and the guys that have the least amount of talent have a ton of desire. And you always say you wish you could get one that had both.
But that's the absolute truth. One of the first things I said to these guys, you know, because these guys, you know, Dr. Toxin had told me that, you know, I could know Doc as well as I do. We'd do in his training sessions a lot of times. He would talk and he would give, you know, oh, we had this one guy on the team and oh, he was this and he was that. And he would, you know, just kind of always tell us about the history of some of the guys that, you know, fought in that gym before us. So we knew, you know, what we had to achieve, you know, what we had to live up to. And one of the first things I said to these guys, I said, I wasn't the most talented. I said, I was a short, stocky guy. I had short arms, I wasn't the fastest, but I hit hard and I fought hard. My first year, I didn't get in shape because I didn't know how, and I lost weight because I wasn't in shape. And I got my ass kicked a few times. I said, well, I'm going to change one thing. I'm going to get my ass in shape. So if I lose, it ain't going to be because I lost because I wasn't in shape. I lost because I brought everything I had to that son of a bitch, and he outfought me.
Right.
And I told him, I said, I don't think I ever want to fight because I was a better talented fighter. I won it just because I was willing to draw that line in the ring, and I was not willing to back down. And I was willing to the other guy down.
Yeah. That's the way to be.
Yeah.
John, what would you say is the thing you enjoy most about being involved in boxing?
I mean, you know, on the personal side, it's the fact that I can still spar and that I still feel very, you know, I feel good. I mean, it's just an amazing thing for me personally. I, you know, some days I box and, you know, I feel like as good or better than I did during my best times when I was an active pro. I mean, just have those days. So, I'm really happy about that. But for me, I guess nothing compares to not just a fighter winning the fight for, you know, that I train, but when I see a fighter and he does something that he couldn't do before and we worked on it and he mastered it and then he has a fight and that's like one aspect of the game that helped him win. you know, to see a guy like not be able to do something and then be able to do it. And he mastered that particular aspect of the sweet science. You know, that's just, for me, that's just, that's amazing. It must be like a, you know, you say like a grade school teacher and, you know, she has a kid and he can't even spell. And then 6 months later, he's spelling, you know, some of the toughest words that, that are in the English language. And so for me, teaching someone something, and it was to be honest with you, I've had fights that I worked corner and I trained a guy for, and he won. And he actually did things in the fight that I either didn't teach him or I didn't tell him to do. He just did it on his own, and he won. So I'm very glad that he won. But, you know, I feel like I can't really take a lot of credit because he didn't win necessarily because of me. But when I train a guy and we do it together and he does something that I actually taught him, something that I learned 20 years ago from one of my coaches, you know, and that's what keeps boxing going. They teach me and I teach them, and then they teach someone else. And 100 years from now, someone's going to learn something that I learned from a guy who learned it 30 years before me. So that aspect of boxing I find very, very interesting and definitely satisfying.
And what would you say is your best personal moment in sport, either as a trainer or as a fighter or both?
Man, I've had a lot that I'm excited about and proud about. Probably, to be honest with you, the biggest moment for me, the one where I had a feeling that I don't think I've ever been able to match, is when I was an amateur going for the Olympic trials. It was always a thing where I felt like kind of like an outsider. Like I knew, you know, there was the top amateurs in the country. You know, you had Kenny Gould and Michael Bent, and you had Roy Jones, you had Michael Carbajal, Kelsey Banks. You know, you had a lot of guys. Everybody knew these guys, and they were favorites of USA Boxing. And one of them, Darren Allen, he was the world champion at the time. He had actually beaten Henry Maskey for the world title, and he was a superstar in amateur boxing. And you know, I always felt kind of like an outsider. And as luck would have it, we both went to the Eastern Olympic Trials, which he was the defending champion in 1988. And as luck would have it, we ended up matching up in the finals. And so the winner of our fight would go on to the Olympic trials. And so for me, it was bigger than just the Olympic trials. It was, you know, beating him would mean that all that those years weren't for nothing. Like it would be, beating him would mean that I belonged, you know, that I proved myself. And I just really, I mean, I stepped above my level. I fought better than I ever fought in my whole career. And I beat him, and I not just beat him, but I won the Outstanding Boxer Award of the tournament, and I qualified for the Olympic Trials. And, you know, so overall, I'd have to say that was my my biggest moment total of my entire career.
Cool. And what's your ultimate goal with the sport as a trainer now?
I mean, you know, I've been lucky enough to have had some success. I trained Jose Rivera when he won the WBA world title on Showtime, and I trained Mike Oliver when he won the IBO title. But I think I'd like to train another world champion. I just, you know, I've had some good fighters. I had the opportunity when I trained Chad Dawson. When we split up, I always tell people it had nothing to do with us personally. It was unfortunately the boxing business at its worst. He signed with Gary Shaw, and he was in the process of leaving his promoter here, Birchfield, and it just caused us to not be able to physically work together. I couldn't have him in the same gym, but that was a big opportunity that I didn't get to pursue. But I would love to be there. I mean, when we won the title, Jose and I on Showtime that time, and 2006, and you know that it's different winning a world title and winning other titles and other fights. I mean, it's definitely a different feeling, and I'd really like to be at that stage again, and hopefully with Mike Oliver, with Salido, I'll have another chance at it.
And what do you have coming up? Any big fights coming up recently with your guys?
Well, we have, I have an amateur, one of my amateur kids, he's fighting next Saturday, on a big show that we're doing here in Connecticut. And again, July 23rd looks like the date for Mike Oliver with Salido. So, that would be the next one. And then there's actually I trained a preliminary fighter. He's by the name of Joey Perez. He's a very solid up and coming junior lightweight, and he's fighting on a show that's in his hometown of Holyoke, Massachusetts, in the same building where he actually won the Golden Gloves 6 times. So that's going to be for a local show, it's going to be a very big, high profile show in our area. So, that's coming up in June 25th. So we've got a few guys that are busy at the moment.
That Holyoke's the same town where I think Rocky Marciano had his professional debut with it.
I believe so. I know he fought there more than once, and, actually we're fighting in the same building as the Golden Gloves were held for like 48 years, and it's actually the same arena that Mike Tyson won the Golden Gloves in Holyoke in 1983.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You actually got to spend a little time with Mike over the years, right? You met him personally and worked out.
Yeah, we actually. Well, it was a funny thing. He was training at my gym, and they closed the gym just for his people, but. You know, I got in, I just walked in and nobody threw me out. So, and it was actually an honor. I mean, I started talking to him and we got to talking, and he could tell by some of the names I mentioned. I actually mentioned the guy, Jimmy Johnson, that he beat in the Golden Gloves in Holyoke, which nobody would know that name unless he was there. So he said, oh man, you know, so we talked for about 10 minutes. And he was intrigued because I knew a lot of the amateurs that were amateurs when he was, guys like Kimuel Odom and Wesley Watson, guys that, like I say, only a boxing historian would know these guys. And then he said to me, he goes, what's your name again? And I saw John Scully, and he goes, oh, he put his hand on his head. He goes, oh, man, I'm sorry. I didn't recognize him. He was actually apologizing to me because he didn't recognize me because he knew who I was. He said he saw me fight, and... You know, and I was just amazed. I was like, oh, don't be sorry. I'm just amazed that you even know my name. So, you know, and I have to say, he was actually a really good guy. He was very, very down to earth, and, you know, the total opposite of what I think a great many people would think he would be.
Yeah, he gets quite a bad rap. I mean, Customato really did have a great impression on him, and he was such a great boxing historian back in the day that ability didn't just come out of nowhere. I mean, he really took it seriously.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you a funny thing. Now, when he beat Jimmy Johnson in Holyoke, that was in 1983. Tyson was only 16. And a couple of years later, Jimmy Johnson drowned in a boating accident, and I brought that up to Tyson. I said, oh, yeah, he drowned, and he actually said to me, he said, yeah, I heard the propeller of the boat, like, you know, cut him up, and you know, I just thought it was interesting that he would know that he would, you know, that he was own it or anything, but he knew the circumstances of his death, and that always kind of impressed me.
We lost you there for a second.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's one of those things people don't realize because they hear him talk, they think he's, you know, he's got the speech impediment, so he's not smart, but
No, that's farthest from the truth. I found him very sharp, very extremely sharp, and you know, all you have to do is listen to him commentate. I've seen him on a show where he discussed boxing, and I thought he was good. And I've always said I thought he would be great in the role of a boxing analyst on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right, because I mean, not only does he know the sport obviously, but he knows the history of it. So I mean, he could sit there and talk to you about, you know, Joe Louis and Joe Frazier and Sugar Ray Robinson and Rocky Marciano.
Right.
And Jack Dempsey. He can tell you. I mean, he can sit there and say, oh, yeah, look, he's doing like that bob and weave move, just like Jack Dempsey used to do.
Right. Well, you know, not
when he would mean that the, knock out on Carpentier. But I'll
say, right, well, that's what I'm saying. And I think I'm cutting out. Can you guys hear me? I think my thing is cutting out a little bit.
We can hear you. Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, but I was going to say, you know, I consider myself pretty well-versed in history and all that, and Tyson, I've listened to him on TV, and he, I mean, he blows me away. He blows a lot of guys away. I mean, his if you stop and really just forget who he is and just listen to what he's talking about, he could have a conversation with Bert Schubert or Max Kellerman or any of them, and I think more than hold his own.
And talking about Mike, you know, Mike gets a bad rap, you know, because of, you know, and not just the Holyfield fight, but, you know, some of the things he's done in his career and, you know, the prison stints and all that, you know, and some of his controversial moments. But what Mike did that I could, I never got a chance to meet him, but back in 95, when he was fighting in Philadelphia, you know, he was supposed to come in a week before the fight. He came in 2 weeks, and he was going to different gyms all around the city. And he spent 2 days at the rec center where I trained. And now he was doing, the rec center usually didn't open until 3 or 4, but he was getting there around, you know, like 11 or 12 so he could work out in private. And, you know, he'd bring in his own heavy bags and all that. And he would work there for a couple hours and then he would leave before the rec center opened. But he always left equipment because these rec centers, I mean, the guys didn't have much. I mean, I went down there only because my dad knew the trainer and he kind of brought me in. But a lot of these guys are inner city kids. They really didn't have a whole lot. And it was, we all really survived off donations and things being donated to the gym so they could buy equipment and all that. But Mike took his own personal equipment, his jump rope, some of his gloves, and left it at every gym for the underprivileged guys for there.
That's amazing.
And I always,
and you don't hear those stories.
Yeah, I always joke with my dad to this day because when we first started going to that gym in '94, the brackets they had all the heavy bags hung were falling apart. They were very, you know, poor quality. My dad, you know, having a lot of experience building joists and doing all that, built all the joists that are still hanging in this gym 16, 17 years later for all the bags. And Mike Tyson brought his 200-pound heavy bag there. And I said, Dad, I said, it was your joist that held his bag.
Yeah, I saw that bag. They brought it in on a dolly. It was so big, they couldn't carry it.
He's a big guy, you know, what do you expect? All right, John, well, we got to wrap it up here. We got about 3 minutes left on the show. Is anybody you want to give a shout-out to out there, say hello to, or thank, or anything like that?
I want to give a shout out to all the fighters in the world. I people that know me, and if you don't know me, you'll know now. I mean, I'm all about the fighters. I mean, I love boxing. I love the people involved, everything, but especially the fighters. I encourage anyone, to look me up. Give me my email address is icejohnscully@aol.com. icejohnscully. It's my email. It's not somebody answering for me. So, I appreciate it. Anybody wants to talk boxing, feel free to email me. And if you want to read some of my book, I'll send you some chapters of my book. You can have some fun with it.
I'll pass for anybody. I've read some of the chapters of his book. Oh, when you send it to me, I love them.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. And the last point I want to make is I think Klitschko is going to be too big and too strong for David Haye.
Yeah, anything can happen in the heavyweights, but I just can't see Klitschko not winning this fight. You know, I think he's just too big and strong.
Yeah, me too. He's got such a killer jab, too. It's like, you can't get beyond it. It's just unbelievable.
Right.
Unfortunately,
yep.
Makes fights boring, too. But, hey, the heavyweight division we're stuck with, so we got to deal with it.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to let everybody know your website is IcemanJohnScully.com. We have it linked to the actual show. We get a link out there on the blog. I know you're on Facebook, too. How do people find you on Facebook? And you got a big Facebook.
I have two Facebook pages because the one, they only allow you 5,000 friends, so I'm booked up on one. So you have to look up the one that says John the Boxer Scully. And you can find me on John the Boxer Scully.
All right. Well, it's been great talking to you, and we look forward to watching you guys move up the ranks, and best of luck in the future, and we'll be in touch.
Hey, I appreciate you guys having me very much. I really do. Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, have a good night, John.
All right, buddy. You too. All right.
That does it for us here at Fight News Unlimited. We got 30 seconds left to go, and it's pretty much all we have anyway. So,
when we get the Iceman on, that's always a treat. I was glad he could be on with us. I love talking boxing with him. His knowledge of the sport. I mean, I love it being a fight fan. Well, we're the 10-second warning. This is the 22, and I'm out.
All right. See you next week, folks. Thanks for stopping by.